This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Tommy Sowers is that rare jack-of-all-trades who actually mastered some. As a kid from small-town Missouri, took an ROTC scholarship to Duke in the 1990s, actually one of the very last students accepted in class, and that would be one of the last times that Tommy Sowers would finish last. After graduation, he served as a combat engineer in Kosovo, became a Green Beret, did two tours in Iraq, earned a Ph.D. at the London School of Economics, and taught at West Point. In 2010, he ran for Congress in Missouri's 8th District, called for an end to the war in Afghanistan. He lost that campaign, but soon after, President Obama nominated him as an Assistant Secretary for Public Intergovernmental Affairs at the VA, and that made him the youngest Assistant Secretary in the nation at the time. Came to North Carolina to teach public policy at Duke, and then a personal experience looking for a home led him to build a startup that matches home buyers with real estate agents. And he is my guest this hour on The State of Things. Tommy Sowers, welcome. Good to have you here.
It's great to be here, Frank. Thanks.
Take me back to Missouri growing up. Talk about your childhood.
Well, born and raised in a small town, it's a college town, Rolla, Missouri, and I've got three older sisters, and it was really sort of an idyllic raising. Public school educated, and hunting, fishing, Cardinals, baseball, that setup. But there, I really learned about faith and family and hard work, and it's actually one of the things that drew me back to here is this community here, I think, is a wonderful community where you can really grow and raise your family.
Your dad, kind of a jack of all trades, too.
He was an entrepreneur. He started in the newspaper business. It included then after that fish farming and then soft frozen lemonade sales and land development. And so, he taught me something that I came back to in the military, and then it's happened in politics. But he's like, son, you miss every shot you don't take. And if you don't bet on yourself, who's going to bet on you? So I come from that in a lineage, and I'm proud of that heritage.
Military does play a big part. You came to Duke on an ROTC scholarship, right?
That's right. That's right. So, Duke certainly isn't cheap, and it wasn't cheap back then. And ROTC gave me an opportunity to try it out for a year. And my mom's side was military, but I didn't really grow up with it. So at that point, it was, let's just try it out. Let's see how it works. After about a week, my dad asked me how it was going, and I said, well, I like it. I just don't know if I like all this taking orders stuff. And he reminds me of that from time to time. But what I did love is the deliberate approach to understanding leadership. And I think most of the veterans out there get this, which is, the military doesn't just throw you into a scenario and say, throw you in a scenario without the right equipment. And one of the first things that it equips you with is it teaches you how to lead. You start by leading yourself, and then you lead two people, and then four people, and then steadily you can progress to leading hundreds of Iraqis on complex operations. But it starts with a premise that leadership can be taught and should be taught and should be studied.
So then you took that to Kosovo. Tell us about that and sort of what brought you there.
Well, I was a combat engineer in the Big Red One, 1st Infantry Division, and had just finished up Airborne Ranger training, and this was in 99. And this was kind of what the military was back then. You would, the engagement pre-9/11 was maybe you'd go to the Balkans and do some peacekeeping operations. And I was a platoon leader at that time, and I just found out Frank was in Kosovo as well around that same time. It's interesting because you go in thinking that there's good guys and bad guys, and certainly there was a lot of bad happening prior to us getting there. But you get there and you realize there's a lot of gray, and it was something that came back to me later in the military is being very conscious of which group is trying to use you to further their own goals. But on the flip side, I also saw, it was one of my first times really seeing true, poverty. And the Albanians were so thankful for us to be there. And it was my first opportunity to work with Green Berets. So I had a chance to work with a team of Green Berets. And, I pictured them like John J. Rambo and diving out of planes and knives and teeth, and they're actually a lot smaller than in person.
It's just because your imagination had them 15 feet tall.
Oh, yeah, exactly. But, you know, when I worked with them, the thing that drew me to them, I mean, Green Berets are special folks. They get plunked down into ambiguous situations. They're sort of the entrepreneurs of the military. Highly trained, very talented, ambiguous situations where they've got to sort it out and figure out how to accomplish that mission. And what they test you on when you're going through Green Beret training is fundamentally, is your mind right so that it will never quit?
Well, and as you said, talk about shades of gray. You could not think of, for an American reading the American press about the conflict in Kosovo, what could be an easier thing to understand? A majority of the population, 90%, oppressed for hundreds of years mm-hmm. by a small minority of people who then were acted out in violence after the fall of communism, et cetera. Very simple to understand. Those bad guys were hurting those people, and they finally got their country back. How could it be any more simple? And it really wasn't. When you got there, the social relations and the economic relations were complex. So this brings us to the Green Beret and having to actually see it, not for what the American press has pointed out or
yep.
sort of portrayed it. What do you see on the ground, and how are these people related to each other?
Well, you know, we definitely saw it in Iraq, and you see it again in Kosovo is when you have – you know, in Kosovo, you would start a discussion between Albanians and Serbians, and next thing you know, it's 1389, and you're standing in the field of blackbirds, and you're talking about Ottomans. And I mean, there is.
And you had to sort that out, right? Because you had to actually say when you're thinking it happened 2 weeks ago, and then they point out it was 1399.
Yeah, it is. It's people know their history.
Yeah.
And that's something that Green Berets, in particular, are. I mean, we want all of our soldiers to know the history, but truth be told, I mean, if you told a lot of soldiers, like, what is the difference between a Sunni and Shia kind of at the very base of Middle East conflict, a lot of them wouldn't be able to say it. Getting an understanding of the history, the culture, the language. I mean, you and I were just speaking a couple words of Albanian. Being able to say please and thank you to an Albanian in Albanian. I learned the power of that really early on because language in Kosovo was controlled. And so just even speaking a few words, and the same thing happened in Iraq, if I spoke Kurdish or Arabic, it shows a sign of respect. And functionally, if you want the Albanians or Serbians to kind of work in line with American goals, you have to approach it with some cultural understanding and respect.
So you were not a Green Beret then. You say that's when you first really understood kind of what they were doing. What were they doing in Kosovo, and what were you doing?
Well, so I was a combat engineer. So I had a platoon of about 20-some-odd soldiers. You know, combat engineers sort of build things and blow things up. They're sort of infantrymen.
How's that for job security?
Well, yeah, it's there's always business. And so our mission was varied. Part of our mission, we had a sector that we kind of patrolled, and there were little Serbian enclaves that were really under threat. So therein, you know, lies the immediate challenge. You come in and you think you're going to be protecting Albanians, but in fact, you come in and you're protecting Serbs. And so my first mission was going to the Russian sector and actually working with Russian soldiers because the Russians were getting shot at by Albanians. So the people that we came in there to basically protect, I ended up being sort of a bullet shield for Russian soldiers to, you know, protect them from those same people. So at a very young age, you learn a lot about the true complexity of the world.
What about the Green Beret? What were they doing there?
Well, you know, they at that time Russia came into Kosovo, and I think it was keep an eye on the Russians, yeah. See what the Russians are up to, and what they're doing there. They came yeah. in separate from the UN and NATO mission. So, you know, and this is 99. It's complicated. So, again, the best I could say is they had a broad mission of do good things for America. And that that's actually what really appealed to me about Green Berets. It wasn't, you know, diving out of planes. It was that. It was being entrusted and being able to work with incredibly professional people on an ambiguous mission that matters.
Because a lot of it has to do with understanding and gaining the confidence of local populations. So you've got to understand how this system works.
There was a lot of breaking of bread. There was a lot of violation of General Order Number 1, which prohibited drinking alcohol or any of that. I mean, what was needed at the time, yeah. You know, the Green Berets did.
So that's when you decided to take up the course, right? You decided to become a Green Beret.
That's right. And so, you know, initially it was, I'll join the military, I'll do 4 years, I'll get out and get into business like I am now. But kind of two things happened. I met Green Berets, and I said, you know, I'd like to continue my service. I thought I'd continue on in the National Guard. But then, of course, 9/11 happened, and I was over in Germany, and I realized just what a unique opportunity I had to be sort of right there at a place to do something about it.
Well, it's one thing to want to be a Green Beret. It's another to become one. We'll find out how that went when my conversation with Tommy Sowers continues, former Assistant Secretary of the VA, now runs a Durham-based startup called Solo Pro. We'll talk about all of that when our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking with veteran and entrepreneur Tommy Sowers. So tell us about that Green Beret training. You said, hey, I want to sign up, and then what?
Well, they remind you that you've volunteered for this many times. And, most of it's here in North Carolina, and it's sort of out the back gate of Fort Bragg. And you know, what they're trying to test is there's other schools out there like Ranger School that are predominantly physical challenge. But what Green Berets are trying to test is definitely physical, but more mental. And they're operating off of this main fear that a lot of people have, which is uncertainty and the unknown. And so what this first phase is like, which has a very high attrition, they basically just don't tell you what's going to happen next. And they let people's mind work on themselves. And we had about an 80% attrition in that first phase. And it was an exercise would be the next exercise is a run. Do your best, follow the cones, begin. And you want to know whether you're running for 2 miles or 8 miles. And so the next would be maybe a math test or a land navigation. And they're just seeing how you cope with uncertainty.
And there are levels of testing, I guess, you
That's
go
right.
through. And so is it fair to say that the first level is just the physical, just to see if you can take it? And then after that, we're going to spend more time figuring out about your mind?
No, they pretty much get right into the mind. But then, then it's small unit tactics and jumping out of planes and some unconventional warfare and a great exercise here that it happens in rural North Carolina where it's this huge elaborate Robin Sage exercise where citizens throughout North Carolina play roles and parts and you're actually conducting, a multi-week exercise off base. So it's very, very elaborate, interesting, and I mean it's befitting. I mean we're trying to create some very elite professionals to work with, and it's good when you're on a team to know that everyone else went through the same 80% attrition.
Well, and so talk about that. That means that pretty much every day or every week, somebody who you knew was telling you they quit, or you'd wake up and they weren't there, right?
Yeah.
So why didn't you? I mean, what are the challenges? Because obviously it's grueling. If there's an 80% attrition rate, there's good reason for people to leave. And that leaves the question for those who stayed. What were they telling themselves? What were you telling yourself along the way to keep yourself in?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you make up your mind ahead of time, you're just not going to quit. I mean, it sounds so simple, but you're going to know that you're going to want to quit. You're going to know there's going to be times where that's going to happen. But then when that comes, you're ready for it. And I also do a lot of commitments to other folks. So when I'm, whether it's running for office or whether it's I tell a lot of people I'm going to do it. I tell people I'm going to do it well. And then also I draw a lot of strength from the people that I'm going through it with. I've got a great crew with me building this business, and we're committed to each other. And you know, you learn that in the military, and it continues to this day.
You went on a 50-mile trek as part of this, and I guess that's when you really had to have a big roster of friends and family to get you through,
that,
right?
That's right. There was a trick that I used to do, which was I had this sort of list of people in my head, and for every mile where you wanted to quit, I'd picture, like, my dad walking with me or a sister or a girlfriend or whoever, just kind of walking with me, and I'd walk that mile with them.
You talked about Robin Sage, which is this, and maybe I'll ask you to elaborate on that a little bit more, where in North Carolina, whole communities are involved, and you get volunteers from the community to play roles, often the role that they might play in their community, a mayor, a public official, that sort of thing. Tell me more about how that works, because I think it illustrates some of the mission of the Green Beret, and again, this more than just sort of capturing the hill.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is you're capturing hearts and minds. You really
That's
need
right.
to integrate with the community and then make some quick decisions and sort out kind of the truth from the fallacy, and you can't get that in the newspapers.
Yeah, you know, Green Berets, you operate in a small team of 12 folks, and so it's never like, when you have an enemy out there, the first step is not let's figure out how to destroy the enemy. The first step is how do we get that enemy to work with us? How do we get them, you know, they might never be fully on our side, but let's get them 51% on our side. And so, you know, this exercise, Robin Sage, they create a fictional land called Pineland, and it's in really central North Carolina. And so you end up meeting with, you know, role players and folks, and you have to learn how to get them at least 51% on your side.
Well, and I know there was a tragedy several years ago where there was sort of a mistaken identity, and I think a law officer mistakenly killed one of the trainees as part of that. So if anybody has that memory, that was indeed that operation. You got through all that. You got through the training. What was your first mission?
Well, the first mission was in 2004 to lead a team in Iraq, and that was, you know, sort of just in the run-up to the first election, a lot of uncertainty. We were in the Sunni Triangle or Saladin, which is a mixed province, and very, very complicated is probably the best way to say it.
Yeah. Well, and you talked about liking and noticing when you were in Kosovo and sort of serving in the regular army as an army engineer, the autonomy that Green Berets seem to have. But that there's a downside to that, too, as you
right.
pointed out. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about
that. Well, you know, I loved being sort of left alone with my team in a city, living in a house with a lot of autonomy. That was the good side. The bad side was it didn't seem like we were executing, like, phase five of the 12-phase operation. It was sort of do good things for America. You rotate out in 7 months. Some other people come in with their own interpretation of that. You come back 7 months later. You say, that last group, they didn't know what they were doing. Let's kind of start over again. And so that sort of lack of this core strategy was those were kind of the seeds of a political campaign years to come.
Your training as a Green Beret was unusual in that you were also – that's when you decided to go to the London School of Economics. Am I right?
I was a little before that, but I won a Rotary Ambassadorial Scholarship, and I love Rotary, this idea of service above self, and I was able to pause my training for a year to do something very, very different and go to London and get a graduate degree.
In what?
In public policy.
All right. So you went there and eventually got a PhD.
That's right. That's right.
So you did your first tour, as you said, your first deployment in Iraq. You went back for a second, right?
That's right. And that was later on. That was sort of right in the midst of the sort of thriving in civil war. And so that's where I would say, you know, much more frustration in terms of, you know, we owe it to troops when they go over. And look, we've got thousands of troops back in Iraq right now and thousands in Afghanistan. And having a clear, articulated strategy, I think, has got to be the minimum of it. Later, when I taught at West Point and taught the Constitution, you read about all these powers of war that are out there and how the founders actually wanted war to be considered, which was really a national effort. And we've got a long way to go.
Talk about the difference between your living conditions in those two tours.
Well, the first time I lived in a house in a city with 11 other Americans and, you know, ate a lot of local food, probably had diarrhea for about 7 months straight. The second time was on one of these big base complexes, and you could have lobster tails and smoothies and, you know, Pizza Hut and all that stuff. So very, very different.
But also watching some very high-tech forms of warfare.
That's right. That's right, when drones and all that were coming in. And, you know, the Baghdad Command Center was as sort of elaborate as you can imagine. Lots of screens, lots of information. Question on how useful it was to make great decisions. But, yeah, very, very different deployments.
But you could actually watch. I mean, I think there was one moment where you're actually watching a commander direct, you know, a small group to find an insurgent, like, in real time.
Yeah, this is the kind of double-edged sword of technology. I mean, it allows you – I mean, we all know that – have seen the picture of the president watching the raid go down on the Osama bin Laden raid. And there's good there, but there's also, you know, maybe not at that moment, but I definitely saw plenty in Baghdad where – the use of technology, you graft these tools onto organizations and you don't really explain how they should be used, and they can be used and misused.
So what's the downside?
Well, the downside is if you're a strategic commander in charge of all of Baghdad and you're focused on interdicting one IED in place, or you probably should be focusing on the strategic level and not the tactical.
Right. And I think there was even a moment where you were leading an operation where the technology got in the way of what you – your best judgment.
Well, yeah, I was in a complex operation with about 100 Iraqis, and I tried to call in air support, and they said your airspace isn't cleared because a boss's boss had put a drone on top to sort of watch what I was doing. And, you know, it's loud, it's dark, and when you need support, you need it right then and there. And just to be told you can't because someone's watching you is, that was a little frustrating.
Come up with your own version of the Truman Show,
right.
And you're thinking, I really don't want to be a star at this moment. I want to succeed in this mission. And I'm also curious to know about and how unusual it is to be engaged in this kind of training, Green Beret training, active in these missions, watching the scope of this war change from, the sort of the initial phase, which was to eject Saddam, to then refereeing and interjecting ourselves into civil war. A lot has changed. In the meantime, you're getting your PhD. I mean, what's going on with your head? Sort of tactically involved and then intellectually engaged at that level.
Well, so the PhD work came a little later, but what did happen is, you know, I got to sort of study how government should work in theory and then how government works in practice with real tough issues there, which isn't just sort of marginal changes, but how do we move from 40% unemployment to something less than that? And you know, you see it. You see the role of government, and you cross a border and you see sort of the difference of people and their lives and their ambitions and government plays a huge role in that. And good government plays a role, and bad government can also play a role. So I think that really led to the idea of wanting to serve again in a different way.
Well, you talked about, too, the problem of engagement, the fact that the American people seemed not to be interested and certainly weren't and weren't making the sacrifices in terms of personnel. It was coming from a small sector of our society. And we saw that complaint over and over again, where Americans were complacent about what was going on and didn't feel the pinch of this war in a way that, kept them engaged. And yet we are the government. So which government are you talking about? Talk about Ronald Reagan's government. The government is the problem, because that's a thing. But that's a thing abstract from us that almost reinforces our disengagement or an engaged government. And then how do we get that back?
Well, I think this is one of the things that drives me is back in Greece, citizenship wasn't automatically conveyed. It was earned through either a vote or service. And really what the question was, were people involved in the issues of their time? And, war is a central issue of a time, and we shouldn't be able to fight it on the cheap. That's something that – and you, I don't cast blame at one party. I don't cast blame at one branch. But, we get the government that we vote for, and we get the government that we deserve. So if if we want a government responsive to war and concerns, we ourselves have to care and be involved in it.
Well, that Greek democracy you talked about was began precisely because of the democratization of war. People had to have their own. I mean, the Bronze Age was over, long over, and so the idea that a lord could muster an army and support it was gone. Everybody had to get their own little iron instruments and defend themselves. And they said, hey, you know what? If I'm going to bleed for this town, then I get a vote. And that's more or less how it came about. We're not doing that. We don't kind of make. And I just wonder if they – and it seems to me political discourse encourages that kind of disengagement. We'll take care of this and we'll either blame the government or we'll fix your problem. But either way, you just go home and subscribe to Netflix and you'd be fine. You know?
Well, you know, this was one of the drivers for me to run was we had our lowest number of veterans in Congress since World War II, and Congress has a very active role to play, articulated in Article 1, Section 8, and a number of other places in the Constitution. That's one role that I thought I could play.
Well, before I get you that campaign, you also taught at West Point, right?
Yeah. It was a great way to sort of end a military career. You know, you spend so much time learning in the military, and that was an opportunity to teach. And I taught the Constitution. I just learned how much I loved teaching. I just relearned it again by teaching at Duke this past year, and it was truly an honor to teach.
So tell me more about this campaign now. You did run for the 8th District in Missouri. Maybe you can describe that district for us. Again, I think you wanted to, as you said, represent veterans, certainly, but also the 8th District of Missouri. But tell us more about that. Characterize it for us.
Well, it's where I was born and raised, and, you know, I'd sort of been away, but 28 rural counties. I think it's the 9th poorest district in America. And like a lot of places in America, small towns that used to make something, and they don't make anything anymore. All the factories have closed. And, you know, that sort of small town upbringing, actually, I mean, I sort of live in the country here now. I love it. And I like the values it represents. But it's going away. And I wanted to really be a champion for that way of living.
Communities like that, I mean, 9th poorest in the country, and it's all over America, rural areas and urban areas alike. People who if there was a government, are being terribly underserved by their governments, and you would think there would be howls of protest for change. But talk about the politics and kind of how that works. People...
Well, you know, I think
you ran as a Democrat.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the challenge is, you know, when I was looking at it, there's a huge incumbency advantage. We all know that, and people talk about term limits and lots of other things out there that could solve it. But, you know, I was looking at it, and I was like, wow, this looks really hard. Maybe I should let everyone else do this or someone else do this. And it was this very clear epiphany to me. And I mean, I found it, you know, again, with my business, I found it with trying to make change at the VA, is like, quit waiting for this to be easy. Of course it's hard. There is no garden path that's going to be laid out before you to make change. But, you know, do the thing that you did in the military and I do today, which is surround yourself by a great team and have a very clear mission and work hard and don't wait for somebody else to do it. And, you know, that's what really I feel like I can't teach citizenship or teach soldiers or teach students without having done some of that myself.
Tell us a little bit about the campaign. It was an uphill fight. You didn't have – I don't think – was there a challenge for the Democratic primary? They let you have it.
Yeah. Right? So you know, it was interesting. You know, it takes a lot of money to do it. And we came out of the gate and we raised a lot of money and got a lot of news. But there was this kind of second epiphany, which is why was I running like a sort of standard campaign? It wasn't looking like it was a good year to have a D behind your name. So why not run like the candidate I always wanted to be? Run the truth. Run a 34-year-old tobacco chewing. I don't chew anymore, but I did at that time. Boot wearing, dog owning, truck having guy. And as soon as we made that decision, we wrapped our truck like a NASCAR truck. We went out and worked all these dirty jobs and castrated cows and worked in convenience stores. And and, you know, really became a true candidate. And I think a lot of people run and they regret it, and they the people involved in the campaign, especially me, don't. I mean, namely, I also met my wife during the campaign, so it was clearly the best decision I ever made.
You did run. You did also at that point. I mean, again, you know, present yourself as a candidate who is kind of the people. You took the unpopular position that at that time that the U.S. should get out of Afghanistan.
That's right. That's right. And I mean, they teach you a lot of things in the military. One of them are the principles of war, and one of them is the objective and having a very clear objective. And to me, you know, that challenge was, you know, if the objective is to train the Afghan military and leave at one point and leave it in instability, my central question is just kind of thinking through that. Who's going to pay once we leave? And, of course, we haven't left. This is 6 years on now. And you know, it's a huge expense. So, you know, there's an old saying in the military, amateurs talk strategy and professionals talk logistics. And looking at the logistics behind some of these decisions, not just in the immediate term, but 5 years down the road is absolutely critical.
On the State of Things today, talking to scholar, soldier, and businessman Tommy Sowers. And our conversation will continue in a moment. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest is veteran, professor, and entrepreneur Tommy Sowers. He runs the Durham-based real estate company Solo Pro. Done a lot before that. Talked about running for Congress. You did meet your wife. How did you meet?
She was front row in one of my speeches. And, you know, she smart and good looking and then somehow put up with me as a candidate, and that was just prep for the, you know, for the rest of our lives. So I realized if someone could tolerate me then I found someone special.
You picked a loser. You stuck with me. Although you didn't come in last. There were a couple of candidates who were actually behind you.
Well, so I came in a distant second.
That campaign is over, but your political or your career in Washington is not. President Obama nominated you as Assistant Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs. Tell us about that phone call.
Well, you know, after the race, and which was not close, 2010 was not timing was not good. But, you know, I got a lot of calls afterwards, and one was, hey, you don't know this yet, Tommy, but, you know, if you're a young person, you run a great race, you actually can't lose. And I was like, well, you know, I'm going to Mexico. I'm not wearing a shirt for I'm not asking anyone for money. Yeah. I felt like I lost. But because we ran a good race and ran on principles and values, I think, you know, that made a name for us. And so when I did want to serve again, and it turns out I think my demeanor is much more suited for the executive branch anyway, of having a budget, having a mandate, and being expected to act and deliver. And, you know, this role was sort of a C-level executive of the VA. The VA is a massive organization, $151 billion a year to take care of 22.4 million veterans. And, you know, as a veteran, I have benefited so much from the VA. The VA home loan is my current home loan. My health care is through the VA. It's Dr. Sowers because the post 9/11 GI Bill. But it turns out only 40% of veterans utilize services. And part of my role and responsibility was to increase awareness.
Did you know that going into the job, that only 40%?
I did not know that fact, yeah. But I came straight out of a management consultant role at McKinsey and was all numbers driven. So mm-hmm. I said, you know, what's the utilization, 40%? And then is that a good number or a bad number? And it got really quiet when I asked that. And I said, well, should it be 80%? Should it be 20%? How do we know? We polled veterans and found out that only 40% of veterans know something about the VA. And mm-hmm. so there's a strong correlation between that. So doing a few things with such a massive bureaucracy is tough. But when you do it right and people become aware, I mean, these benefits change people's lives for the better. Accessing them, tough. But once they have them, they're fantastic benefits.
Well, how tough was it? Because you talked about the budget and the size and the scope of the mission, and that means, as you just suggested, it's not easy to get a thing like the Veterans Administration or the Veterans Department of Veterans Affairs to move even half an inch.
Yeah, it's, I mean, and, you know, I was at the assistant secretary level, which is two levels. You know, my boss was the secretary, boss's boss was the president. And so even at that level, it's tough. I had to learn a lot about budget and personnel and kind of use all that by, with, and through stuff you learn as a Green Beret, because you're not going to do it alone.
Did it work? Do you feel like you've accomplished anything?
I had a couple of wins. I had a big loss, and I learned a lot. And if I get an opportunity to serve again, I'll be better next time.
All right, we'll start with the wins.
Well, a couple of things. We did the first awareness campaign, and we know about 200,000 folks came in. But we're using that as a kind of precursor campaign to a great campaign that taxpayers have already paid for. And it got shelved due to, you know, reasons sort of beyond my control.
But this was a campaign to bring awareness to benefits?
Yeah,
to know
there's, you know, 22 vets kill themselves every day, and 18 of them have never sought VA health care. So you can make all the improvements in the world to the VA, but if you don't inform veterans of their benefits, that should be really step one. And so, you know, in all those things, I learned, you know, both in the political campaign and in government, you know, timing has a lot to do with these things. And the timing wasn't right, but it should be right, and it should be something that our government does.
All right. What about the loss?
Well, that was it.
That's, I mean, that was just not getting it.
Yeah, not getting that campaign through. It's on the shelf. It's evergreen. And yeah, I mean, like every day that there's a veteran out there that is uninsured and goes into an emergency room and doesn't realize there's a VA system out there that you know, doesn't get educated because they're not accessing the GI Bill. I mean, that's a loss, and that's something that we should do better.
Well, you talked about the teamwork and kind of building consensus and working with people and all of that. It makes sense. But how is that different from, I mean, I would have to think that your experience as a Green Beret in the field and your experience as a bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. had to be very, very different in terms of expected outcomes. Was it? Can you really do the same kind of team building and mission focus that you've been there?
It's different. I mean, the first Special Force in Perry, you got to understand the operational environment. You and I were just talking about D.C. is its own animal. But you know, when I got there, my wife said, hey, look, you got 2 years. You know, let's go fast. And let's do what we can so it's not just getting co-opted by the bureaucracy. And I got some good advice from mentors on that, too. And it's one of the great things about our system of government is, I mean, yes, I worked in a bureaucracy. I wouldn't call myself a bureaucrat because I was an appointed official. And when you come in there, I think that's there to refresh the bureaucracy, to try to bring new ideas and push things forward. And so I was lucky to get a few things done.
They know you're only there for 2 years.
Yeah, but you know, that's true. But we, you know, I try to say instead of us and them is we. I mean, yeah. You know, I think a lot of people go into service and they really want to get something done. And so we spend a lot of time kind of figuring out exactly what that should be. And when we win, we win.
You did come back to Durham and came to teach at Duke. Why?
Well, you know, I love Duke. I graduated there, and one of my mentors had me down for a class while I was assistant secretary, and I got back in front of students, and I realized I just loved it. And, I mean, that's – I see a life kind of weaved between entrepreneurship and public service and teaching. And I got an opportunity to build a couple classes and fundamentally teach what we were just talking about, which is leadership in government and why people should be involved in the issues of their time. And, you know, the students are smart and great. One just emailed me, you know, today, and you form just a very unique bond with them. So hopefully it's not my last teaching gig, but It was a great honor to come back and teach.
Came back and taught, and then you started looking for a house, and that led you to the business that you started up. But tell us about that house hunt.
Yeah, the origin of Solo Pro was we were standing outside the house that we had found on Zillow and or you know some online website. And you know, like 10 million people last year, we purchased a home, but like 7 million, I was a repeat home buyer. And I know that I didn't need the full service of a buyer's agent, and using a buyer's agent is very expensive, actually, more expensive here in America than almost any other developed country. And so I'm standing outside this house, and I'm like, I just need to get in this house. I wish I could hire someone just to let me in this house. So it turns out that it was a bank-owned property, and it was abandoned, so the back door was open, and I got in the house.
A little Green Beret training.
Maybe Green
handy.
Beret.
Yeah.
Did you blow the door? The back door was – the back door is now much more secure than it used to be. It's probably the best way to say it. And, you know, we got in. We liked it, and then I went to close, and they said it's not just the price of the home. It's the price of the home plus 6%. Which, of course, we all pay when we buy a home. But when you're writing that separate check for almost $20,000, you're like, wow, I don't write checks for $20,000 for anything. Why am I paying this? But if I could hire somebody just to perform that task and found an agent that could help me close, and then North Carolina is one of the 40 states that now allow full rebates. And you know, at the end of that day when we closed, the agent was paid. Agent was happy. I received a very large check that I, you know, put into the home. And that was really the core of the idea, which is how can we bring buyers and agents together, but not every buyer is the same and they shouldn't have to pay 3%. And frankly, the thing I didn't realize at the beginning is there's 2 million agents, real estate agents, and their average income is $33,000 a year. There are a lot of agents out
nationally,
there.
Nationally? Is this nationally?
That's nationally.
Wow.
And first year or second year agents, it's under 10,000. And there are a lot of agents out there that would love to set their hours, set their rates, be good at what they do, but maybe not do the full suite of what it takes to be a full-service agent. And SoloPro.com is the first pro-agent, pro-buyer platform that allows this to occur. And we're live here in the Triangle. We've got dozens of local real estate agents who have come and unbundled their services. And if you're purchasing a home and you want to receive – you don't need the full suite of services and just need a few things and then want the full rebate when they close, you can do that on SoloPro.com.
Yeah, and interesting. I mean, so say unlike another – you know, sort of in the gig economy, we think of an Uber. But in that case, the Uber case, you've actually put the professional driver out of the picture. You're keeping the agents in the picture.
Well, that's right. One of my co-founders is a real estate agent and has sold $200 million of real estate, knows the industry well. And we respect agents. We know that buying a house is a complicated transaction and professionals will very likely always be involved. Actually, Realogy, which is the largest industry player, just named us one of the top three startups in the nation. And one of the reasons is because we are pro-agent. And so if you're a real estate agent, you should come to SoloPro.com. You can find another way to make a living through it. And if you're interested in buying a home, you should come to SoloPro.com.
You're going to have to stop that right now. Listen, let me ask you this, though. The landscape in Durham as a startup, I mean, this place, because you could have gone anywhere, I suppose. Why did you choose to stay here?
Well, we were looking around. We were, you know, I mean, one of the core reasons is we love it here, and it's a great community. But what's changed since I graduated here in the late 90s, I mean, this is a thriving startup scene now. I mean, I work in the American Underground. That didn't exist, you know, a decade ago. There's capital, there's labor, and we're seeing that actually in our own company. Our designer is from the North Carolina State School of Design. One of our advisors is one of the lead advisors for the UNC School of Media and Journalism, and some of our investors and talent comes from Duke. So you've got this perfect petri dish for startups and new ideas. And we're proud to call Durham home, and we're looking for talent. So that's one other thing. Tommy@solopro.com. If you've got interesting talent or ideas that wants to come work for a growing startup.
Do you think that, but that's an email address, which means I can get to you from Finland if I want to. What is the import? Is there really an importance of being geographically centered, having all that talent in one place, when in fact you can put out the word in the big wide world and find it?
Well, that is we have folks in California. We've got folks here, but I'm a little old school like that. I like to touch and. I shouldn't say touch, but I like to be with the
yeah.
team, and we're building our team here.
Right.
There's great talent, great values, and a great environment to build a company.
How much would you say your military training, or did it play a part in your ability to build a business?
Well, I think for SoloPro, it's very similar. It's there is uncertainty. The way you get past that is you have a clear objective, you surround yourself by great people, and you execute. You work really, really hard. I'm not certain exactly how SoloPro, if a year from now it's going to be exactly the way it is today, but we're going to succeed. And, that uncertainty, that unknown doesn't stop. So I'd say that's one lesson that I learned from Green Beret training that applies to leading a company like SoloPro.
What about politics? You have any interest in getting back in?
I've had an opportunity to serve a couple different ways, and it's in my DNA. Right now, I'm very focused on building a family and building a business, and that is keeping me busy. I know at some point I'll serve again. That may be teaching. That may be in the executive, that may be running again, but I was never one of those guys, and you meet them a lot in politics, that already has their eye on their office in 2020. Maybe I should get clear on my objectives there. But
get your head together. You're not doing anything else except running a business and just getting here from Washington. Tell me, getting back to Veterans Affairs, though, and the treatment of veterans, we are obviously seeing more and more. Our combat activities seem ceaseless over the globe, and that seems now to be the role of the United States. We've taken the role as policemen of the world. And therefore, there will be more veterans, and the needs will grow. What are we going to need? I mean, it seems that we were never prepared for this. How do we scale up, or can we, to meet the needs of America's veterans?
Well, it's actually a little counterintuitive. The number of veterans is going down. And the reason is of course, World War II and Korea and Vietnam veterans are passing. So one of the challenges, I think, is as you have a smaller percentage that has served, and as that smaller percentage is then therefore represented in the halls of Congress, how do you maintain a high level of care after the guns fall silent? It is shocking, but I believe she's still alive. We at least last year, we were still caring for the child of a Civil War veteran. Now, that is mind-boggling, but what I bring that up to say that these decisions have incredibly long-term consequences. And what I can say very, very thankfully is that, this administration, supported by Republicans and Democrats in Congress, has been very, very generous to veterans and the VA in terms of funding. But having that funding go in the right way, in a much more efficient way, I think is something that is an absolute requirement going forward.
Tommy, great to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here, Frank.
Tommy Sowers, former Assistant Secretary for the VA, now runs a Durham-based startup called SoloPro. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Andrew Tai is our intern. Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.